music for the heroic allegory of Prometheus. He's the spirit who finds human beings in a state of ignorance and takes it upon himself to polish them up a little through art and science and good morals. The music for Creatures of Prometheus by Beethoven with the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra. I'm Allison Young. Thanks for joining me.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn, playing beautiful classical music just for you. If you have a business or organization that you would like to partner with WHFR on in getting the word out about what you do, well, we would love to talk to you. We call that concept underwriting or sponsorship, and WHFR, although a non-commercial radio station, is always open to partnering in sponsorship or underwriting with your great local business or organization. If you'd like to talk more about this very cost-effective way of getting information out about your business and letting the community know that you support WHFR, and believe me, our loyal listeners are just that, very loyal. We'd love to talk to you. Give me a call, Susan McGraw, WHFR General Manager, 313-845-9842. That's 313-845-9842. Love to talk about underwriting.
The federal government has removed wolves from the endangered species list, and the trophy hunting is underway in western states like Idaho. Saving wolves from human encroachment and destruction is a topic of keen interest to pianist Hélène Guimond. She sees herself as a bit of an outsider and says that wolves, like music, saved her life. We'll hear from the woman who dances and plays with wolves in a concerto by Ravel on this hour of classical music.
You are listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR Dearborn. And next, we bring you one of our WHFR Forum shows. The Forum show we are highlighting for this week is Then and Now with Ned Apigian. Stay tuned.
Morning. You are listening to Then and Now, presented on WHFR Dearborn from 10 to 11 a.m. in the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of the WHFR Forum, our weekly talk show format. Then and Now is a pre-recorded program on WHFR at 89.3 FM, Making Waves, that primarily deals with how history affects current events. And now to our host, Ned Apigian, with today's program. Ned?
Thank you. Well, good morning. Today is a special program of which we are going to talk about the 93rd anniversary or commemoration of the Armenian Genocide, which began in 1915 in the Ottoman Empire, and the conclusion says till 1923. That depends on how you view conclusions. Our guest today is a very special woman who's not Armenian, which makes this interesting. She's a high school teacher in Indiana, And her name is Mrs. Rosemary Russell Bowes. And thanks for coming, Rosemary.
Thank you, Ned.
Well, the reason why, as you know, this program's title is Then and Now and How History Affects Current Events. Those of you who may have heard something about the Armenian Genocide recently, there's been quite a controversy in September of 2007. The Armenian community was quite active in bringing before it a House Resolution numbered 106 to have the United States Congress recognize the Armenian Genocide. This resolution went before the Foreign Relations Committee and passed by a vote of 27-20, as I remember. And therefore, then it became an issue to be brought before the full House. And we in the Armenian community thought that this would be something that would finally be addressed, although previously in United States Congress, I believe, in 1974, such a resolution passed. Much to our chagrin, the Turkish government spent a lot of time and money and was prepared, hired a lot of public relations firms, and the Armenian question got pretty well slaughtered in the major American press, not foreign press, American press, and we were caught off guard about it. This time we have a friend, Nancy Pelosi, that did not bring the issue before the full House. She promised the Armenian community that she would bring it before the full House when we had won more than half the votes to guarantee its passing. And it's unusual for a resolution to come before the House that has more than 200 co-sponsors. This resolution had 225, I believe. It's necessary to have 218 to pass. We lost about 12 people, but pressure from the president and the State Department. However, the publicity about the failure of this is more significant to us than its passing, because it was covered in the news so often that people start to ask, what is this Armenian genocide? And that's how Rosemary is going to say, how in the world did she find out about the Armenian genocide in Indiana, in a place where there aren't many Armenians? And she's going to tell us something about herself, and then how she discovered this thing, and inform us about it, our listening audience. Hence the title of the program, Current Events Have Their Beginnings in History. And people would say that, you know, Resolution 106 didn't just fall out of the sky. Rosemary, why don't you tell us something about yourself, how you discovered this? And
Ned, I am hoping that my thesis will go to full committee this summer. Have some corrections that need to be put in. The title of that research is The Revival of Haytad. Haytad, as you know, means the Armenian cause. Armenians call themselves Hay, and they call their country Hayastan, and they call their language Hayeren. So Haytad is a reference to the Armenian cause.
So how did the world get to call us Armenians?
I heard it was possibly Romans.
Actually, I think I know the story of that, but we'll talk about that later.
I introduced the historical and political events surrounding the genocide in my thesis, and with the hope of familiarizing my readers with the grassroots political movement among Armenian Americans. When my academic work is completed for Indiana University, I'm studying at the Fort Wayne campus, I will have earned my MA in English with emphases in composition and linguistics. Now, my family, I'm sure you want to know about my family. My husband is a graphic designer by trade and an artist and craftsman in his leisure time. We've been married 21 years, and we have two, of course, wonderful sons. David's a freshman at Indiana University studying Near Eastern language and culture. Jared is a senior. He graduates in June and heads off to IU with his older brother to study trombone. As an adjunct for the last several years, I taught freshman composition, about 10 years. Currently, though, I am teaching senior English at Warsaw Community High School in Warsaw, Indiana. My research into the Armenian Genocide began about 8 years ago when I stumbled upon the phrase while reading an interview with a theologian in the popular evangelical magazine Christianity Today. His name is Dr. Bilezikjian, and his parents were survivors of the genocide. After I finished the article, I looked for the information on this genocide he referenced, but about which I had never heard. One thing led to another, as they say. I searched bookstores, the library, the internet. And eventually, I found myself in grad school, and it was there that I undertook a project that allowed me to interview the children of survivors. A lot of people thought I was wanting to talk to survivors, but I wanted to talk to the children of survivors to learn about the legacy of non-recognition of a genocide.
Depending on when you started, there aren't that many survivors left.
This is true, and people were helping me find a survivor here and a survivor there. But I would continually remind the children, it is you to whom I want to speak. It is your story.
Let me take a minute. We're having a little bit of trouble with Rosemary's microphone, and we can't have that. So I'm going to introduce an area of how we're going to cover this matter. And Rosemary, and now that she's told us how she discovered the Armenian people way down in Indiana. Isn't there a song about that somehow?
There are a couple of them. Jim Nabors sings one.
Anyway, way down in Indiana, which are the friendliest people? I remember I stopped at a gas station to buy gas driving through, and everybody wanted to say hello to me while I was pumping the gas.
Yeah.
What a strange place this is. Why can't they just mind their business? Anyway,
they probably thought you were particularly rude then, Ned.
No, I didn't say anything. I just thought it to myself. So anyway, where do you want to begin your expertise as to how this story began now that you've done?
Ned, if we want to talk about House Resolution 106 and some of the current events, and then if you want to go back to perhaps
tell us what you know
the 19th
about 106.
Century and up into the... Well, why don't we just discuss it? I know you felt like it got slaughtered in the press. A lot of Armenians were very happy that the subject of the Armenian genocide was getting so much press.
That was my sentiment exactly. Actually, I never believed it would pass.
And I think a lot of people didn't believe it would pass.
I think, and I'm a person that's involved in projecting that every year. I think there are better things to do, but it turned out wonderful, all the publicity. That's
right.
My opinion.
I know that there was YouTube, actually. There was available film on YouTube with one of the, is it Jane Harmon in California, who withdrew her support. She promised her support. And then there was some pressure brought to bear, and she said that she would not be voting for the passage of that resolution.
Well, actually, we gained Mr. Lantos, who recently passed away. Mr. Lantos was somebody that wasn't a supporter of ours.
That's true, and he voiced at that vote that day that was broadcast on the internet, he said that he did not think that this was a good time. So there was support, basically talking out of two sides of your mouth, I think they say.
Well, I don't know.
Offering the support and then saying this is not a good time.
I don't know when is a good time, but there's never a good time not to say anything bad about Israel, is there? Is there a good time?
I think that in terms of the Armenian Genocide Resolution, one of the complaints that the Armenian community has, the Armenian American community has, is that there are usually reasons given, especially adopted by the State Department, that have to do with this is not good timing because. For example, I helped a gentleman in Fort Wayne, Zorab Tazian, write a letter to the editor in which he retraced the various times in history, recent history, when that resolution was being put forth and then eventually put down. And he claims that there is an excuse every time, and most recently has been the Iraq War.
Yeah, well, the whole idea is not to offend the Turkish state because we have bases there or had a base there. But the interesting thing is they claim that if we did this, the Turks would have incursions into Iraq. Well, we didn't pass the resolutions, and the Turks have had three incursions into Iraq. So that it proves to be means nothing. Secondly, the Americans wanted to enter Iraq through Turkey with the 1st American Division. The Turks denied them that, so I don't understand why they're trying to placate them. They take the money and they tell you no. They recently had an election of which they didn't want an Islamic government to be a majority. We have an Islamic majority government in Turkey. So I don't know. When is the good time?
You know, because of the ignorance of the American people about the Armenian cause and the history of tension between Turkey and Armenia and Armenians in diaspora, they don't understand when the excuse is brought up about the Iraq war that really this doesn't have to have anything to do with the resolution. And as you and I both know, it was a non-binding resolution.
Right.
So the American public, and I would say the American public in general, the samples of which would be my family and friends who emailed me and called me, why do the Armenians have to do this right now? And they know who the Armenians are because of my research. Why do they have to do it right now during the Iraq War? Because they don't have a lot of knowledge on the subject, and it's constantly linked with the Iraq War, they're worried that the Armenians are agitating for something that will endanger American foreign policy, and more specifically, the American effort in Iraq.
Yeah, but everything they wanted to do, the Turks didn't let them do anyway. Doesn't make any difference.
But a lot of people don't have a knowledge of that internal working between the State Department and Turkey.
Well, they don't know a lot of things, the American people. But in 1974, the Turkish state invaded the island of Cyprus, occupied a half of it with American military equipment and what have you, and they haven't resolved that problem yet.
But for Americans, as you know,
So why don't they take care of that?
For Americans right now, the most important thing is the safety of the troops in Iraq. If they are led to believe that passing a resolution, a non-binding resolution, will endanger any of those soldiers, they are not going to support it.
Well, I don't know how it endangers the soldiers, but anyway, it is getting time for us to have a station break. Usually about a quarter way through the program, we stop to let you know who you're listening to. You are listening to Then and Now, which is a program on the forum format of the Henry Ford Community College. And we are on WHFR FM 89.3, making electronic waves so that you, our listening audience, can get informed on the various subjects. And today, on Then and Now, we have our guest, who is Rosemary Russell Bowes, who is a high school teacher in Indiana, who has educated herself on the Armenian genocide, and it's a thesis, her master's program. She is extremely knowledgeable. And here on the 93rd anniversary of the Armenian genocide, which is usually celebrated around the 24th of April, Rosemary is our guest. I guess, have we covered enough of 106 where we can go into What is this all about? Like people would say to me, well, people get killed all the time. And after all, they murdered these people 80 or 90 years ago. So what? Dead is dead, right? So I could give examples where dead is dead is not relevant.
Actually, I had a family member say to me, Rosemary, this happened a long time ago. Why are the Armenians? And this, again, this was at the time of 106 when they felt like they could broach the conversation. I said, you know what? There are people alive who didn't have any grandparents, who didn't have any first cousins. Somebody killed these people. Furthermore, they're not buried anywhere. Can you go and visit a grave?
That's the other thing is, when people say that to me, I like to come back to them and I say, well, the Jewish Holocaust was 60 years ago. Dead is dead. They're dead. Why do you keep talking about this? Why is that so important? At one of our seminars, which the Jewish community, Armenian community, sponsor at Wayne State University, which you attended last year, which I do annually, these happen to be Jewish intellectuals, very interesting people, said they were talking about the number of documentaries. There are over 9,000 movies and documentaries about the Jewish Holocaust. 9,000 of them. In fact, he illustrated a couple that were done in the 20s, which I didn't know anything about, which, if you remember, they were staged things, like as if they were news. There isn't 90 such TV 30-minute things that have been developed in the last 90 years about the Armenian Genocide. Excuse me. There was a time when I was a young man passing leaflets out in the streets 30, 40 years ago. You would run across an octogenarian, somebody 70 or 80, would say, I remember that when I was in school, they were collecting pennies for the Armenian genocide survivors, the orphans, and we had a recognition of what happened, the Dodge, the Near East Relief, all those things Herbert Hoover did that nobody knows about today, and yet so and so when dead is dead, and well, I say if dead is dead and it doesn't make any difference, then why are we talking about the Holocaust every week? Every at the movies, I go to every one of them. I love them.
But you know, in American law, there is no statute of limitation when it comes to murder.
There you go. Isn't that wonderful? Too bad there weren't Americans that were murdered. Oh, a little bit of news. The recent, I'm sure our listeners, some bright person found out that Armenians had insurance policies. Jay, our station manager, will you really think this is interesting? He brought a class action suit against people, against the New York Life Insurance Company, and guess what? They collected like $10 million given to individual survivors if they could prove relationship, and to the Armenian Church and some Armenian organizations. Now, that was the beginning of the first one as a recognition. Isn't that interesting?
I think that some Armenians were really happy that if this compensation was made, then obviously that is some sort of
recognition.
That is compensation for the cost. Then there's acknowledgement of the crime. But because it went to organizations, it really didn't come back to the individual families, as I understand it. But at least it was a step that something happened to these people. Where did they go?
Yeah, well, it was passed out. You had to apply, I don't know. They never published a list of who got money, but I know people who got money. So anyhow, the interesting thing about that is the major Turkish criminals, if the average know, let's say the equivalent of Goebbels or Göring, the Turkish leaders tried to collect the insurance policies on the Armenians, saying there were no more relatives. So Talat Pasha at the time wanted to go to New York Life and said, look, the Turkish state has to be the beneficiary. If that isn't tantamount to a laughable issue that needs to be brought to...
I believe Morgenthau records that, doesn't he?
Yes,
He said, just give us that money because the Armenians aren't here. I'm referring to Henry Morgenthau, then ambassador... American ambassador to Armenia. To Turkey. By the way, his memoirs are available online.
Is that right?
Yes.
Is his book and republished?
His book is online.
Is that right?
Yeah, as well as, can I mention just another book here?
Anything
you
like.
If you look at, for Henry Morgenthau, his book is available online, the copyright being up on that. Also, Bryce and Toynbee. You can find them in books online as well. And more recently published is Christopher Walker's book on Armenia, Survival of a Nation, a wonderful book that is also available in its entirety online.
I'm wondering, is there anybody have those where the talking books, you can put them and slip them in your car? And while
I don't. If perhaps some of the memoirs, but I would
have
to do a
reading it
search.
Online, I don't like, I'm not
well,
a
Well, a lot of young people do. That's how they find it. So for that,
well,
that
that
generation.
Leaves me out. I'm not young.
A lot of the kids are happy to work on.
Well, then we got to tell them that. How do you spell Morgenthau? Get your pen out.
Morgenthau.
Thau.
Mm-hmm. Morgenthau.
Okay. I wasn't
who
sure
was
about
a Jewish American, as you said, assigned to the the embassy in Turkey at the time under.
You know what's interesting? His children and grandchildren are still active in politics in New York with the same name, Henry Morgenthau III.
Yes, yeah.
And at Armenian commemorations, they always show up and recognize. It's an interesting thing at that time. Why would the American president send to the Ottoman, at the time, it would be the Ottoman Sultanate, a Jew to represent America? In fact, it's Talat Pasha, who was an important Turkish leader, would say, what is it to you? These people are not Jews, you know. What difference does it make to you? But not only him, but I think two or three of the previous four were all Jewish Americans, which turned out to be a blessing for us Armenians. Morgenthau certainly was. It's too bad that the Jewish state today is not more akin to seeing the Armenian genocide, because they are people who suffered this. And I like to go into, why don't we go into the term genocide? Why don't you tell us about how the term came about? And it came about because of the Armenian genocide.
And by a Jewish scholar named Raphael Lemkin. I think he was a lawyer.
Some His people family... say he was Hungarian or Polish. Do you know for sure? I'm not sure.
I do not recall offhand. But his parents, his family perished in the Holocaust. And, you know, Churchill said this is a crime without a name. And Lemkin took the Greek word genos from genos and added it with the Latin suffix side. So you have the killing of a nation. So then it had a name. And if you read Samantha Power's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, mm-hmm. America and the Age of Genocide, Pulitzer Prize for 2002, I believe, there is an excellent history, a compilation of information about Raphael Lemkin's work in coming to that term and then furthering a fight for...
Do you remember the year? I thought thought he got into this prior to even the 19 Jewish Holocaust.
Well, here's how it worked. In terms of coining a phrase, genocide, I believe, is the earliest date. Yes, the earliest date is 1943, and I think you find it in documents at 1947. But he was familiar with the slaughter of the Armenians, by all means.
It was based on his study of the Armenian, then referred to as the Armenian massacres. Genos in Greek means what exactly? A race?
Nation, a race.
A race.
Ethnos.
In Greek. Homicide comes from the Latin.
Right. Side is to kill.
Right. And the homo is of one person. Homicide would be the murder.
Genocide is the group of people.
Group. Yeah, that's something I didn't know. I didn't know about the genesis of the Greek in the Latin word combination. But anyone, no one knows about Raphael Lemkin. Now, would you like to delve into some of the reasons why for this? And based on what you know, why don't you go into what you know? And if there's something I can add, I will. But the guest.
Lemkin? Are you?
No, about the beginning of the why would the Turks do such a thing?
Well, Ned, I'm certainly going to ask you to participate as a conversation and not for this to go as a
monologue.
Well,
based on what you know.
Right, and I know you'll know more.
What you learned.
I understand is that the Ottoman Mille system broke the empire up into the religious, which were then also the ethnic groups. And it worked well. They survived among each other. However...
You mean the Turkish word millet?
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Mille, right. And I've seen it as mille in some other pronunciation.
Well, maybe it would
it looks
have
like
a French
millet.
But I think the
if you
Turkish
see it M-I-L-L-E-T, you can say millet.
Yeah.
Millet or mille. You might see it either way. That's a reference to the religious communities. You know, it's...
I only know it because my mother and father used the word and they spoke Turkish. Rarely, only among themselves if they didn't want me to understand what they were talking about.
But they
use the term millet, so I don't know if that's the correct...
I've heard it both pronunciations.
Yeah. Anyway, what the Turks did is they were a minority in the Turkish Ottoman Empire. And so it was very interesting how a minority of people ended up governing more people who were non-Turks than themselves. And how they did this, as you described, they divided their... into religious communities, and they dealt with the heads of the various religious communities. And those of you who are interested in the problems of Iraq, the Sunnis, the Shia, the Kurds, The Turks apparently were smarter than Churchill and Lawrence of Arabia and whatever that. What was that woman's name? Beatrice something or other. B. They were instrumental in combining these three sections of Iraq, one Kurdish, one Sunni, one Shiite, into they created the country of Iraq. So those of you who didn't know where that
is. It's about 20 years old. I mean, since 1920, isn't it?
Yeah, 1920. What they did was, they tended to do this. Actually, the Bolsheviks, when they had the Russian Revolution and they exposed some of the secret treaties that the English and the British had with the Tsar, in order to embarrass them, see, they came here to liberate you. They had the Arabs, the whole Lawrence of Arabia story, and the Armenians, too. They had an Armenian legion fighting with the Russians on the Eastern Front. Then they had an Armenian group. The French had a French foreign legion fighting in Syria, and the British had a group fighting in Palestine who actually won the Battle of Arara, as I remember, with Allenby's forces. And they promised all these subjugated peoples that if you help us defeat this hated, terrible Turk, then we're going to give you your independence and recognize you. Then they went to the Jews and they wrote a famous document called the Balfour Agreement, which they made promises to them. Hence our problems today with the Arabs and the Jews, because they made promises to the Lawrence. All you got to do is see the Lawrence Arabian movie, and the Balfour Agreement is not covered. So what happened was the Bolsheviks let out the news that the English and the French had agreed to divide the Levant into areas, spheres of influence. They gave the French Syria and Lebanon. Churchill and this woman in Lawrence of Arabia created Jordan. They invented Jordan. They actually drew a line in the sand, called it Transjordan. And the same thing in Iraq. And then since they're used to having kings, they went to Mecca and they picked three Hashemite princes, Prince Abdullah, Prince Faisal. No, I can't think of the third one. Prince Faisal's the character in the Lawrence of Arabia movie. They made him king of Iraq. So they took these three regions of Iraq and said, you are now Malik in Arabic of Iraq. They took Prince Abdullah, which is the Jordan's Hussein, who recently died, that has these American wives. His grandfather, Abdullah, which was assassinated in the 1930s, and they made him king of Transjordan. Well, whatever that is, that's my phone, and it shouldn't go off.
One right? thing I want to mention while you're talking about that, Ned, is the 19th century saw a movement, a breakdown of the empires, and a movement in nation states. So the independence movement was spreading in Europe, and that, of course, spelled danger for the Ottomans in the Balkans.
Well, that is very true, and it goes back to, do you ever wonder why so many cities have Greek names, like Ypsilanti and in
Jordan? How about Istanbul? That's Greek. Istanbul in this city.
I didn't know
Mustafa
that.
Mustafa Kemal.
I thought Istanbul was a Turkish word.
No. Oh. Here's how it looks in Greek. Ace.
Well.
Tane.
And it means what?
In this city.
In the
Mustafa Kemal wanted to be more Western.
I see.
And he traded Constantinople for.
We got to talk about that. I need to put that in my repertoire.
So when we come to the 19th century and we have that Hohenzollern empires, we have Austria-Hungary.
Yep.
And we have Russia, and we have the Ottomans, and we have the French and the British.
Anyway, it's perfect time. It's 30 minutes into the program, and you are just listening to our guest today, who is Rosemary Russell Bowles, and I am your host today, Ned Apigian. I think the first time I didn't identify myself. Well, here we are. We're talking about the roots and causes of the Armenian Genocide this April 24th. And Rosemary is the guest of the Armenian community, which would be, well, in the case, Sunday, the 20th of April. And we are talking about the some roots of the causes of the Armenian Genocide. Previously, she told us how she got interested into this subject, of which where in the world in Indiana would she have come across that. And now we're giving you some background about the past, and you are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM, and we're here at the Henry Ford Community College making waves and hopefully entertaining, educating you at the same time. And now we will continue with the beginning of the... I wanted to go back to, unless you can go back further, with the so-called, in history, as we learn history, they keep talking about the sick man of Turkey being the sick man in Europe, because they had influence in Europe. And they began to lose their influence, and they began to lose parts of their empire, which at one time stretched from North Africa into the Arabian Peninsula, into Mesopotamia, and up into the Caucasus, and into
Europe and Africa.
into Eastern, Southern Europe, the Balkans, including Greece. In 1829, the British helped the Greeks liberate themselves from the Turks in their war of independence. And from this period on, you're talking about a period, let's say 1829, it would be 70 years in the 19th century. And we're talking about a period of 85 years from when the Turks looked at themselves and said, look, we are not going to be able to hold on to a Turkish Ottoman Islamic Empire composed of captive people who are non-Turks and non-Muslims. And they came to that conclusion as they lost region after region after region, beginning in the end of 1909. They lost Libya, or Tripolitania, to the Italians in a war. And then they lost the Balkans to the Bulgarians in 1911 and 1912. And they only suspected that it was only a matter of time to, even though the Arabs were Muslims, would long to break from the Turkish Ottoman Empire and create their own state, nation states. And therefore, in order for the Turkish Ottoman Empire to survive, it needed to look to its beginnings, where the Turks came from, the mythical breeding ground of the Mongolian Turks who came from the Altai Mountains in China, and that they needed to look east. In other words, instead of from Istanbul west into the Christian world, dominated by Christian peoples, to look east to all the Islamic peoples of Central Asia who spoke a form of Turkish and were all Muslims. That was called Pan-Turanianism, and what's in the way of that was Armenia. In other words, in order for this arc of influence to be successful, it would have to go through Armenia, because the gap between the Caspian and the Black Sea is Armenia. And this is the reason why they came up with their genocidal policy against the Armenians. It is not a matter of a question of faith. It's not a matter of they're interested to kill all Armenians. If they could have exported every Armenian out of that region and put them on a train or a plane or a boat, that would have been their interest to clean that part of the world of Armenians. So that whatever happened to us, that's the basic reason for it.
You know, when they looked west, what they saw was Europe, who was supporting the Bulgarians and the Greeks, for example.
Absolutely.
And their claim was that these were Christian people, and they were supporting them because they were Christians against the Ottoman regime. And in 1876, I believe, there was a terrible massacre among the Bulgarians, and Europe stepped in for that and told Turkey, you cannot carry out these slaughters. Unfortunately, for the Armenians, this kind of help did not come for them when they were being slaughtered. They were so deep inside the Ottoman Empire on their historic lands. Europe could claim some affinity and in the Balkans because it was Europe and these people were Christian. But their political expediency changed for the Armenians.
I think there was an expression, a British battleship can't sail up Mount Ararat in a landlocked country. But one thing did happen. In 1876, there was a peace treaty of Berlin, which later became the peace treaty of San Stefano. There was a war between Russia and the Turkey, and the Russian army occupied pretty much a lot of eastern Turkey today, and we're at the gates of Constantinople through the Balkans. A relatively harsh peace treaty was made. The Armenians thought they were liberated, but the Western powers decided Russia was getting too much influence, and they had to rewrote that Treaty of San Stefano and created the Peace Treaty of Berlin. That's the beginning of what we call the Armenian cause, question. The Armenian question. So therefore, the English and the French, the Austrians said, okay, you can't have that much influence. So therefore, the Russians had to take less. But what that created was the beginning of the Armenian cause. So if the Russians weren't going to take from Turkey, the Armenian sections of Turkey, then they had to have some requirements. Then this is the thing that irritated the Turks. Why are you having so much to say what goes on into my country? And then they had a couple of reform sultans, Sultan Medjet, and then before the Red Sultan, Sultan Medjet's father, right now off the top of my head, I can't think of his name, that came up with, in the 1860s even, a special constitution for the Armenians. So they were, there was this period of reform. And even prior to the beginning of the First World War, we had the massacres of Adana in 1909. This is after the Turks in 1908 said, look, we're making a new deal with all of our subject people.
You know, let me back just a little bit on that. One of the things that happened when there was land lost in the Caucasus, there were displaced Muslims. So there's an influx of refugees
and Mujahideen,
they wanted to make room for them. And one of the solutions is, of course, to displace the Armenians and to give the Ottomans preference, literally their lands and their homes.
The people from the Balkans.
One of the things that perhaps some listeners will understand and some will not is how the greater powers of Russia and Europe played chess in this part of the world based upon who was Orthodox, who was Catholic. So whether you could say a people was a Christian then allowed you to say, we are going to be a protectorate of these people. So Russia would then have a hand into Turkey if Russia were to say, we want to protect those Orthodox Christians.
You are absolutely right. Even into the Second World War, if you would remember, the First World War was caused by the fact that the Serbs were Orthodox and the Russians stepped in to help them, created the First World War, without going into that study, into that deeply. But also in the Second World War, the Nazis used the Bosnians, which the Americans, at the request of Turkey, went and helped. No one ever tells us in the news, these Bosnians are Muslims. They created a Muslim republic in Europe. They never talk about that. They have war with Islam. You know what they never talk about
still,
that?
That's still, if you care about current events and you're talking about the Armenian genocide, you have to go into the Ottoman Empire. And once you do that, you see Europe and Russia's interests in real estate, because the British wanted to get to the east. They had all of that empire in India. The Germans wanted the Baghdad Railway. Russia wanted a warm water port.
Well, you know what? You just hit the nail on the head. All the problems we have today in Palestine and what we're talking about in the Balkans, the establishment of the Kosovars, the Bosnians, are all problems that were not resolved with the disillusionment of the Ottoman Empire. Nobody knows that. Nobody realizes the importance of that. And when you see that movie, a little later we're going to give you some movies to watch. That movie of Lawrence of Arabia gives you so much insight into this problem. But what you need to know for current events today, imagine here we are in this long war with so-called Islamic jihadists, jihadists. And then what are the Americans doing? They haven't gone to these Muslim people and say, look, we just liberated for you and created in the midst of Europe, we separated a section in a Christian-dominated Islam, actually Orthodox country, Yugoslavia primarily, and we created an Islamic state. They never say that. You wouldn't, unless you're listening to this program and you talk about the Bosnians. When they're talking about Bosnians, you think they're different people? All these people speak the same language, Serbo-Croatian.
They consider them different languages, but they are mutually intelligible. The Croats, the Bosnians, and the Serbs, they consider them three different languages.
The Slovenes and the Slovaks. If you know Polish or Russian, you could talk to all of them, including the Czechs. That's why when they invented that thing, Yugoslavia means Southern Slavs. And if you know Russian or if you know Polish, you'll have no trouble in Slovakia, in the Czech Republic. Now the other interesting thing you said about their background. During the Second World War, the Germans were very much influential with the Croatians. They actually got the Croatians to fight with them. But the Serbs were the Chetniks that fought with the Russians. The British had... And so Tito was, when they say he was a Croatian, but he was a communist and he was with the Russians. And then the British supported a group called the Chetniks, who in the end lost their role. So in the event, I guess Wilson's idea wasn't that good, to take all these people and put them into one polyglot nation.
Wilson is important to bring up as we talk about the genocide, because, first of all, he's an American president, and it makes a connection with the American people and the history of Armenian Americans here. He was the former president of a lot of Armenians, and he had a treaty at the end of World War, or he helped... write a treaty in which historic Armenia would be recovered for the Armenians.
Who, let us mention, points that, were his famous 14 points.
the prelude to our United Nations. But the Armenians...
Which point was the one about Armenia? Does anybody remember? Was it the 10th or the 1st?
The Armenians fought alongside Americans. And they fought for their lands, and they believed that they would recover their homeland... because of...
Well, just a little correction. During this First World War, the United States never declared war on Turkey. They only declared war on Germany. Hence, that's why we didn't have any influence. The American relationship with the Turks and American missionaries who loved their institutions in Turkey, they sent missionaries to Turkey to convert Muslims. You can't convert Muslims, because Muslims, if they convert... Even today, they'll cut your head off. That's the penalty for conversion. You cannot in Islam convert.
That's your opinion.
That was Ned Pigeon's opinion. Ned, can I mention something about some research that's being done? I know Dr. Shirikian, a local former Der Hire, and also grew up in Lebanon. He has research on the American missionaries in Turkey. Also, though, probably... I did hear him in a lecture. Some work that probably is a little comes from a different perspective would be Suzanne Moranian. She is out. Her history dissertation was out of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And Peter Balakian quotes her heavily in his, I think, most current book on the Armenian subject, which is called The Burning Tigris. Now, the premise in the premise in both Balakian's book and Moranian's dissertation is a little more probably from your perspective, where the American missionaries brought something negative. But there are plenty of Armenian writers, the Badveli Tutikyan.
They didn't bring anything negative. They brought education to the Armenians and set them way ahead of the Muslims.
Okay, some people feel that the missionaries had a vested interest in the economy, in the Ottoman economy, and that actually they ended up creating a wedge between Armenians because of the difference. But we don't have to go into that. I thought that's where you're going. But Suzanne Moranian has done research. I know Der Hire Shirikian has, and I know Balakian has on
the American missionaries were a blessing to the Armenian people at the turn of the centuries, but they went to the Ottoman Empire to proselytize among the Muslims. That is not possible.
I think they found that out, didn't they?
It's not possible.
You know, I have to tell you, there is a woman with my same first name. Her name is Rose, and she was actually commissioned by a missionary group in Bern, Indiana. That is my husband's home. And she went, was originally in Goshen, then went to Bern, Indiana, south of Fort Wayne, and got to Turkey from there.
We want to do our third station ID. You are listening to our host today, our guest today, Rosemary Russell Bowes from Indiana, and I am your host, Ned Apigyan, and you are listening to WHFR 89.3 FM, and we're making waves here at our radio station at the Henry Ford Community College, and we're located on the corner of Evergreen and Ford Road. Almost. We just bought the SME building, so I guess we're right at the corner.
Ford Road, yeah.
We're right at the corner. So, and also you could hear us on the internet because our range is somewhat limited, and that's at WHFR.FM. And you should be able to hear. There were a time you couldn't pick us up everywhere, but now you can pick it up generously no matter where you are. I wanted to remind you, a little while ago we were talking about not being, the Protestant missionaries did not realize that they could not convert Muslims. And if you remember, there was a story recently in the press about an Iraqi guy that converted to Christianity. Do you remember that story? He had to leave. You cannot do that. I'm sorry, it's not my opinion. It's in Islamic doctrine. You can't do it. You can marry, a Muslim can marry a Christian woman. There's no problem with that. She doesn't have to become a Muslim either. But he cannot convert. Now,
Ned, can I mention some movies?
You can mention anything you like.
Some movies,
absolutely.
Some videos that perhaps,
especially
the younger...
Please, I'm talking too much as it is.
The younger audience might help put them in touch with this subject. First of all, a lot of my students, both my college and my high school students, really like System of a Down. Unfortunately, that band has disbanded, but they do have a movie coming out. Yeah, Serj released his single. First of all, if you like Audioslave, Serj and the former band member from Audioslave do a lot of political, it's a website devoted to social activism. Also, though, The Screamers came out and was in a few theaters. You said there were three people when you went to see it. There were three people when I went to see it.
Well, depends on the time of day. The Screamers was at Strange Movies. They weren't even at the art movies.
Well, it did have a limited release, but it comes out on DVD in June. Also, some of the clips are available on YouTube. So if you put in The Screamers at YouTube.
Was it a big hit in Europe? People were...
It's really good. I think that if you sat down and watched it with Grandpa, it might be a problem. Of course, we know that if you listen to System of a Down, we have some graphic lyrics. But Serge's grandfather was a survivor.
I saw that.
Of the genocide. And so you see a really soft side of Serge, and then you hear him screaming out the lyrics. Also, let me mention that Ghosts of Rwanda actually mentions the Armenian genocide. I spoke to a couple in Chicago, and I believe their name is Dagdigyan, and their son was, I believe, a co-producer of that video. Whenever I watch videos, movies on the subject of genocide, I wait to see if the Armenian genocide is mentioned, when it was in Ghosts of Rwanda, which is a fantastic documentary.
I was watching a program on called The Warriors on educational television, which I watch constantly. They were discussing, I think, Stalin's statement, of which had to do with the boyars. Who today remembers how the boyars were eliminated in Russia in order to make way for the development of the socialist state?
You know,
let me finish this thought. And then they went and showed pictures of Hitler, and they talked about the Ober-Salzburg meeting that Hitler had in August prior to the beginning of the war, where he said, they quoted him, it was not mine, because some people say this is not right, there's no reference to it, they can't find it. But the documentary said, after all, who remembers the annihilation of the Armenians, and we're going to do... And you must, his expression, well, we're going to have to be particularly barbaric about what we're going to do when we go to Poland. So those two statements, and I understand Stalin once says, the loss of an individual is a tragedy, but a loss of millions is only a statistic.
And Victor Hugo has a quote.
Like that?
Like that, very
maybe
similar.
Maybe Stalin read it.
He made it. You kill one person, it's murder. You kill a million people.
Well, maybe that's where Stalin got it.
Victor Hugo. No, Victor Hugo's quote actually is often cited with subject on the army. If I had a computer in front of me, I'd Google that. But I want to mention Adam Egoyan's movie, Ararat.
Okay.
He's Canadian, and he does have acclaimed films. And I had to drive from Indiana to Chicago to see Ararat.
Yeah, and he has I understand from our station advisor that he's a well-known person of art films, which I didn't. Does his wife act in all his films too?
I think I saw this at Blockbuster. If you're interested in more research on the subject of the genocide, Ararat presents it, but certainly not in. It's a much more harrowing tale. I think that Schindler's List really represents
Armenians could get. What's his name? Slips me now.
Spielberg?
Yeah. Schindler's List.
Schindler's List.
Steven Spielberg.
Spielberg, right. If they could get Steven Spielberg to tell a story, they'd be doing something.
Well, you know who wants to tell the story of Mossadegh right now?
I don't know.
Sylvester Stallone.
I can't
now,
imagine.
But it was back in the 30s that effort to produce Franz Werfel's novel,
right.
But a stop was put to that, and Mossadegh has not been produced in Hollywood. Stallone wants to.
The average person doesn't know anything about that. We ought to tell him something about this.
That's why I mentioned it.
This is a book that was written by another... another German Jew about the Armenian genocide. And... the interesting thing about it is that book has never gotten out of publication, I think. I think it's still available, and the book was written in the 30s.
The 40 Days of Mossadegh, the spelling being Mussadagh, the 40 Days of Musa, and for English speakers it looks like Dag.
Right. What it means is Musa means Moses in Arabic, and Dag means mountain in Turkish. The Armenians say
Musaler.
Musaler. Ler means Armenian.
My friend who's sitting next to me, his grandfather, was part of that resistance. What happened was you have Armenians.
It's Arabic too, right? Musa is an Arabic.
Are on a mountain. The Armenians are on a mountain, holding off the Turkish army. Sheer determination. So that story, and of course the resistance at Van, the Armenians are very proud of those stories of the courageous fighters.
The average person should understand. Unfortunately, the Armenians were more like sheep. Whatever the Turks told them to do, they said, you're leaving your village, you have to pack up, take 2 days' supply.
We have to remember, Ned, the reason we celebrate April 24th, we don't celebrate it, I am so sorry I said that. The reason April 24th is because the leaders were taken away from the Armenians.
Happened is these two incidents are indications when the Armenians say, look, we figured out what's going on and we're going to go down fighting. Now, I'd like you to bring you to another movie. This is a 1964 movie, which Rosemary didn't know about. I'm surprised. I'm going to have to give her my copy and I'm going to loan one to Jay. It is Elia Kazan's last movie, Elia Kazan being a Schindler's List type of famous American Hollywood director who made a story primarily about his family, about his uncle. It's a story about immigrants wanting to come to America, but the subject is not Poland or Russia. The subject is the Ottoman Empire and Greeks and Armenians wanting to leave their subjugation to come to America. And it's a long movie, and it gives you a lot of insight into the mentality of the existence of these two Christian peoples and what they suffered together and why they had to come and the promise of America. It was an Academy Award nominee in 1964, and my father was alive at the time.
Well, you know, that's when I was born, Ned, so I didn't get to go see it.
America, America, Elia Kazan. It is a wonderful thing. It's hard. It was a time you could not find that movie on television. And then all of a sudden, it's so old you can't find it at a video store. So I have copies I loan to people. Elia Kazan, America, America. We have about concluded our program today. I'd like to thank Rosemary Russell Bowes from Indiana, who was our guest today. And we're going to do another topic on this with our usual professor staff from the University of Michigan. This concludes our program for today. And remember, you are listening to WHFR.FM, and you can find us on the internet there. And I hope you listen to us again next month.
Thank you, Ned.
Thank you for coming.
Have been listening to Then and Now, a pre-recorded program brought to you from 10 to 11 a.m. on the fourth Saturday of every month as a part of our talk show format entitled the WHFR Forum. Then and Now is a program primarily devoted to how history affects current events by your host, Ned Apigian, on WHFR 89.3 FM, making waves from the campus of Henry Ford Community College in Dearborn, Michigan. You can also hear this program on the World Wide Web at www.whfr.fm. Thank you.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. We're bringing you non-commercial radio from Henry Ford Community College. This is W.